Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll replay an interview with the Wildlife Conservation Society's Director of Wildlife Health Policy and wildlife veterinarian, Steve Osofsky. We'll talk about the intersection between wildlife, livestock, and human health, and how paying attention to all three in tandem leads to better outcomes for all. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from the volcanic mountains of Central Africa. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation on the intersection between wildlife, livestock, and human health with wildlife veterinarian Steve Osofsky. More and more countries in Africa and around the world now find that nature-based activities contribute more to their economies than traditional land uses of forestry, fisheries, and agriculture. To capitalize on the strategic advantage, Dr. Osofsky knows that an understanding of animal diseases is vital so as to avoid unintended consequences in agriculture or for human health. As a wildlife vet, he's uniquely placed to press for multi-sectoral programs and policies that advance the idea of one world, one health. He has worked in the zoological community as the director of animal health services at the Fossil Rim Wildlife Center in Glen Rose, Texas, and also in a variety of exotic regions characterized by a rich abundance of wildlife as well as pervasive human and animal health challenges. He first experienced East Africa in 1984 and 85 as a Harvard University traveling fellow, and later served as the first wildlife veterinary officer for the Botswana Department of Wildlife and National Parks. Dr. Osofsky's career then expanded well outside the bounds of a traditional veterinary clinical career into a variety of policy positions, including as Biodiversity Program Specialist at the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID, and as Director for Field Support for Species Program in Asia and Africa for the World Wildlife Fund. In 2002, he joined the Wildlife Conservation Society's Field Veterinary Program as their first Senior Policy Advisor for Wildlife Health. And he continues there today as Director of Wildlife Health Policy. Dr. Osofsky is an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Maryland and has served on 8 World Conservation Union Species Survival Commission specialist groups. When we talked in February 2010, I asked Steve how his wildlife veterinarian experiences influence him in thinking about the intersection between wildlife, human, and livestock health, and why it's important to look at these all together.
If we look at what affects people's relationship with wildlife, it often comes down to whether they benefit from wildlife or whether they're impacted negatively by wildlife. And those impacts often happen at the interface between agriculture and wildlife. So if people are experiencing intense predation, if you're raising cattle and lions are constantly taking your cows, you're not going to be very fond of lions. If the scales can be tilted a bit. I'll give you an example. One of the interesting things that's happened in parts of Kenya is some veterinarians looked at just that issue. What were the impacts of predators on Maasai livestock versus the impacts of disease? And to make a fairly complex story short, the impacts of disease were found to be orders of magnitude higher. In other words, the Maasai in this particular study were losing much more in terms of agricultural productivity to, 6 or 8 common diseases compared to the occasional animal that they would lose to a lion. But the difference was the diseases were largely background noise. They'd live with them. They knew they were there, but they didn't have any tools to address them.
Like what kind of diseases are you talking about?
Often tick-borne diseases, parasitic diseases, different types of nematodes that drain the animals. There are viral diseases. There are a whole range. Some of them easily dealt with through veterinary interventions. Often that can be done by providing training and supply chains locally. You don't always have to have an expensive veterinarian. There are things called programs where we train para-veterinarians, sort of barefoot vets, if you will, where you can train community members to, for example, even to do things like vaccinate poultry for Newcastle's disease, they can charge local poultry holders, you know, which are many households, for cost recovery and a little bit of profit and eliminate a devastating disease. And you don't need to be a vet to do that, but you need a vet to do the initial training and help set up the supply chain. But what I was saying is, when the Maasai in this case would lose, you know, they would see the remnants of a cow and see lion prints in the sand, it was a very obvious, visceral, you know, reaction. They wanted to go out and get rid of the predator who was impacting their livelihood. The diseases being less visible, until veterinarians looked at it, it wasn't clear that the disease impacts were so much more significant in terms of milk and meat production. So my point is, if you can bring barefoot vets programs, for example, in the right situations to these communities, at the same time as you're working on conservation, you can actually raise people's thresholds of tolerance for living with wildlife. In other words, if they can improve their agricultural production with some basic veterinary interventions, then the occasional loss from livestock from predation is not necessarily as impactful. But it has to be done in tandem. It's not automatic. And at the same time, you obviously want to create economic opportunities for people to benefit from the presence of wildlife, so that maybe, you know, it's helping communities band together to create their own lodge, which has happened in a number of countries, where communities actually create facilities and create partnerships with tour companies and benefit, again, from having wildlife in their areas. We have to look at those types of creative solutions.
A lot of what you've talked about is the interaction between wildlife, humans, and livestock, and conflicts between all those parts of the triangle. And I wanted to see how this has evolved from your days as a wildlife vet in Botswana.
It's been an interesting route since I left Botswana. One of the things that I saw in the early to mid-90s there was a strong aid presence, and including USAID, our own government's branch of development assistance. And I found a lot of things that donor agencies were doing somewhat baffling, to be honest, being within the government and seeing where I thought the needs were and where, you know, where the technical assistance could be most usefully targeted. I often was surprised at what is often a mismatch between internal needs and donor interests.
Do you have any examples of that you were seeing at the time?
Yeah, I think you would have investments in agricultural development from one donor and investments in the wildlife sector in another donor, often, you know, with some of the same geographic areas of interest. But if you're not working in coordination, you could essentially cancel each other out in terms of not having informed land use planning. And these things have to be looked at holistically, but getting donors to work together was often a challenge. And obviously, this was years ago. Things have gotten better in many countries. I don't want to, you know, paint a broad brush, but today there's much more emphasis on coordinated approaches. You know, a lot of these countries have lots of different donors, and they've sort of gotten fed up and said, "Look, we want your help, but we need to coordinate it so that these projects are mutually reinforcing." Anyway, the reason I bring that up is it really got me interested in development assistance. And although I loved being a field vet and hanging out of a helicopter and doing all that cool stuff, I often wondered if I could potentially have more impact influencing land use planning from a policy level.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that as a vet. That's really unusual to have that perspective in the policy realm.
Well, I saw that, you know, the long-term future of the places that I was immersed in was unlikely to really be influenced for the most part by some of the research we were doing, but more likely to be influenced by political decisions and policy decisions that, you know, the veterinary sector might not be impacting as much as they could.
What do you mean specifically?
Animal health and the relationships between animal health and human livelihoods and development are very, very close, but non-veterinarians don't necessarily know that. Veterinarians have not been incredibly effective at sharing their knowledge and inserting themselves in a development context, and we have a lot to offer.
So, what happened once you had that realization?
And I came back to the States, and I did come back. I came back to Fossil Rim for a few years and ran the animal health program there, and developed a fairly comprehensive international training program. I started to bring a large number of students from overseas to Texas, where we had this large, free-ranging, mostly African game, and did a lot of training. And I was still yearning to get more engaged at the policy level.
So what happened?
I heard about these fellowships, these American Association for the Advancement of Science fellowships, AAAS, in Washington, including fellowships at USAID.
That's the U.S. Agency for International Development.
To make a long story short, I ended up applying to become a AAAS Science and Diplomacy Fellow, and I got one of these fellowships, which was very exciting. And, you know, it was an interesting transition career-wise, but I basically hung up my dart gun, and Karen and I moved to Washington. And I spent 2 years within USAID on the biodiversity team, which at the time, and it may still be the case, but at the time, USAID's biodiversity program was the largest bilateral funder of conservation in the world. So a lot of the funds that were going to the World Wildlife Funds and the Conservation Internationals and the WCSs were emanating from USAID. And that's still the case. It's a very important program. And so I really got a very intensive education, not only on how USAID works from the inside. I'd just been in the Botswana government, so I learned how an African government works from the inside, and now I was learning how my own government worked from the inside. I got to work with the State Department and the Department of Interior and a bit with USDA. It was fascinating. And over those 2 years, I got a better understanding of why aid works when it works and why it doesn't work when it doesn't work. And it was really – you can't learn that any better than being in the belly of the beast. And it was really, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I really have a much better appreciation of what's in, you know, so the bureaucracy of foreign assistance, if you will.
When it works, why does it work? And do you have an example of it working really well that you saw while you were at U.S. Agency for International Development?
I think when it works, it's because, you know, there's earnest partnerships between implementing agencies, funders, and recipient countries. And that's a lot to have aligned. And so, you know, the NGOs that really establish strong local partnerships and go through the transaction costs of developing that kind of buy-in are more likely to deliver sustained results. So, yeah, there are results of successful conservation outcomes and development outcomes. And those that you can see results after the investment is gone are the ones that have involved not only that bridge created between the donor, the implementers, and the host country implementers, but also those that are multidisciplinary in nature. And that's less common.
Now, I know you've devoted a lot of your career to making that more common. So tell me what you've been doing.
In my career since then, one of my emphases has been on recognizing the cross-sectoral nature of a lot of the problems we're trying to solve. And unfortunately, much donor assistance is still sort of thematic. So there's money from the ag program or, you know, from the livestock bureau or from the conservation team. But we're often required to solve problems that involve all those issues.
So what have you done?
You know, after I left AID, I went to the World Wildlife Fund for 5 years and managed programs in Africa and Asia as their director of field support. And tried to apply all the lessons I'd accumulated over the years from not only from the zoological community, but from living in working in Africa. And I'd lived in Africa before I became a veterinarian. We haven't talked about that. We probably don't have time to. But I had a lot of African experience before Botswana. And then applying what I'd learned about being within the U.S. government and at WWF, tried to develop programs that recognized all these linkages. And at the same time, when I was at WWF, I wasn't hired by WWF as a veterinarian. I was more for my programmatic experience in general. And I saw lots of opportunities to look at that, the relevance of the interface between domestic animal health, wildlife health, human health, and environmental stewardship. And
can you describe some of those relationships? Because I think, you know, here in Vermont or elsewhere, it's very different than worldwide. Or maybe
yeah.
It's not so different.
Yeah, I actually think there's probably a lot of commonalities in terms of you know, the health of domestic animals relates directly to the health of and livelihoods of farmers anywhere in the world, and certainly in places where there's an intense interaction between free-ranging wildlife and livestock and competition for resources like grazing and water, which is less of an issue in the eastern United States than it is in southern Africa. The relationship between wildlife populations and livestock populations is an intimate one. And so understanding that and looking at not only basic transmission of infectious diseases, but also that resource competition issue and how it relates to land use is very, very important. And again, looking at livelihoods, you know, looking at how people can benefit not just from agriculture but from wildlife is very, very important. You know, I tell students that my job in many ways is to help make wildlife an economically rational and a socio-culturally acceptable land use choice. Because if that's not the case, then wildlife isn't going to survive. It's a luxury for us in the developed world to want wildlife nearby or in a national park that we can visit. If you're still struggling to feed your family, conservation and aesthetic appreciations of nature is not that common. And so a lot of our work is about finding ways to make wildlife, you know, a sensible land use. And because of things like tourism and things like hunting, that's possible in many places.
Now, do you have some examples of where wildlife, say in Botswana, is basically paying for itself and has become one of the main economic drivers in the
right.
country?
In the late 50s and early 60s, when colonial governments were looking for ways to help these very poor countries find economic traction, they turned to beef exports, and that led to the fencing dilemmas and the conflict between export agriculture and wildlife conservation, where migratory pathways were cut off in many places and hundreds of thousands of wild animals perished. In those days, I don't think that wildlife was valued as a resource.
And how has that changed?
Now today, we can look at the statistics and recognize that in the SADC, the Southern African Development Community, which basically, if you look at a map, is Tanzania all the way down through Zambia, Zimbabwe, Angola, Namibia, Botswana, Mozambique, South Africa. I'm probably forgetting somebody, Malawi. The SADC region, nature-based activities, which include photographic tourism, which include trophy hunting, they contribute more to the gross domestic product of that region than forestry, fisheries, and agriculture combined. Okay, so that's a relatively new development, and it has huge meaning for the leaders of these countries who now want to capitalize on their strategic comparative advantage. And so instead of relying exclusively on agriculture, there is a big push to capitalize on nature and wildlife, and that's led to this interest in transfrontier conservation, on countries, an interest in countries reconnecting corridors, creating links between parks across international boundaries.
So tell me more about that.
One of the projects we've been working on since 2003 is in Southern Africa's Great Limpopo Transfrontier Conservation Area. This is a region shared by South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. And these three countries have signed a treaty to reconnect land areas, not to create one giant national park, but to basically rezone so that wildlife can move back and forth across places that it hasn't roamed in any great numbers for many, many years. The idea being that wildlife as a land use can generate more per unit hectare in some of these areas than any other form of economic activity.
And it's really a stunning thing to say, and to the mindset has to be really different, because for years and years and years, it was always agriculture or minerals that one thought of.
And it is exciting, and it's also a bit unnerving in that, you know, we're not sure whether this is going to work. And I think some of these transfrontier initiatives have the politics have moved a bit faster than the science, if I can say that. We certainly didn't start the Peace Parks movement, we in the Wildlife Conservation Society. But I did, going back many, many years, I saw a need many years ago as I envisioned countries starting to think about this. I saw that we needed to get a better handle on what that would mean, reconnecting these areas, what it would mean for the movements of diseases and cross-sectoral impacts between the wildlife sector, agriculture, and public health. And I'll give you a few examples. In the Great Limpopo, over the past several decades, each of the three countries has sort of evolved its own disease environment. These areas were largely separated by fences. And for example, in South Africa, going back about 180 years, European cattle brought in a disease called bovine tuberculosis. In BTB, bovine tuberculosis is like regular tuberculosis. It can infect people. It's a zoonotic disease, meaning it can move between animals and people. And in 1990, scientists first found bovine tuberculosis had moved into the wildlife of Kruger, Kruger National Park, which is a very well-known park in South Africa. It probably had been there for much longer, but they'd never found it. And once they started really active surveillance, they monitored it, and with almost like a fire burning, it moved, this organism moved from the south of Kruger all the way on up to the very northern part of the park. And so now, largely in buffalo, with spillover into cheetahs and baboons and lions, bovine tuberculosis is sort of endemic in Kruger. If we want to reconnect Kruger, for example, across the border to Zimbabwe's Gonorejo National Park, we need to know what the bovine tuberculosis situation is in Zimbabwe. And scientists are actively looking at that now. And Zimbabwe had done a pretty good job controlling BTB at the time. And we now think that there is still some BTB on the Zimbabwean side. But we need to work cross-sectorally so that people living in this area, if this corridor is eventually created, people who often this part of Zimbabwe where this connection might eventually be put in place between Kruger and Gonorejo, this is a very high HIV/AIDS prevalence area. So people are immunosuppressed. That increases your susceptibility to diseases like tuberculosis. At the same time, culturally, boiling milk is not widely adopted, and meat hygiene isn't very good. And BTB is spread through contaminated milk and meat. And so as conservationists, we have a responsibility to make sure that any vision we have for connectivity doesn't create more problems in the livestock or agriculture sector or the public health sector than problems that it solves for the conservation community. In other words, the net gain has to be there. And the AHEAD program, which is something I thought of many, many years ago, Animal and Human Health for the Environment Development, was really set up when I moved to the Wildlife Conservation Society in 2002 to proactively help countries look at these issues so that if conservation was going to be a land use choice they really wanted to explore, that they could ideally mitigate some of the disease threats as they were developing this vision for connectivity.
Do you have other examples of these kind of disease threats?
Yeah, just as another example, on the Mozambique side of the Great Limpopo, rabies is actually a big problem. And it's because the veterinary services are very weak. Mozambique has a long history of civil war and a weak civil service in many sectors. And so there are a lot of feral dogs who are unvaccinated, and kids often get bitten, and rabies is a big problem. As some of the fencing has started to come down between Mozambique and South Africa, we now are for the first time ever seeing rabies in Kruger National Park, which is a park that's probably the best studied from a disease point of view on the continent, and they'd never seen rabies before in Kruger. Now a dog strain has been found. It's gotten into jackals, for example, and that has potentially significant ecological implications.
Wow, that's really interesting.
To give you yet one more example, in this trinational area, the Zimbabwe component has Nagana, which is sleeping sickness of cattle caused by trypanosomiasis.
How is that spread?
Trypanosomiasis is spread by tsetse flies. As these governments try and reconnect and modify habitats to give wildlife freer range between the three countries, they have to be very cognizant of what types of habitat tsetse flies like and what kinds of ways you can prevent the spread of tsetse flies. Because if trypanosomiasis gets back farther south, that has huge economic implications for livestock, for example, on the western boundary of Kruger in South Africa, where they haven't had Nagana since 1903. And it also has huge implications for things like white rhinos, which Kruger now has the largest population of white rhinos on the planet, thousands of white rhinos. They're actually somewhat susceptible to trypanosomiasis.
Are they really?
Yeah. And so since it hasn't been there since, since the early 1900s, to have it come back now could be quite devastating for the rhino population. So these are all things we have to think about. Those three sectors, we're all trained in our different disciplines. You know, if you learn about agriculture, that's what you're trained in, or if you learn about wildlife or public health. And now, in what we call sort of a one world, one health approach, we really are pushing sectors to work together because real world problems aren't neatly compartmentalized. They're messy and they're linked together. And that's really what we're trying to deal with within the AHEAD program. And looking at these transfrontier areas, we found a receptive audience because these countries recognize that they need some assistance on this. A lot of them have good capacity, but they always can use a boost, both in terms of helping to think through these issues scientifically and in terms of resources to actually solve the problems.
So what are you doing? Say, continuing with the Limpopo example, what is a head doing to help in this area, both in terms of studying it or solutions?
I think the first thing we did, honestly, was help raise awareness about these issues and their potential risks of not getting them right. And I'll be honest, in the Limpopo, as I said, some of the political drivers of reconnecting this landscape are moving faster than the science. So I'm not going to pretend that it's all going to go well. I think some of the horses are already, or some of the zebras are already out of the barn in the Great Limpopo, and that's unfortunate. But what we have done, I think, that wasn't happening as much as it needed to, is help bring these sectors together.
So what exactly is the AHEAD program?
We are largely a facilitator. We are a convener. So we've, within countries and across countries, we've literally helped get folks from the ministries of agriculture, ministries of wildlife, and ministries of health together at the same table to look at these issues and agree that they all have a stake.
And
that wasn't happening.
Is that the first time that they've really worked together that way?
Yeah, I think that a lot of that convening wasn't happening. And you know, a lot of the Peace Parks movement was driven by the conservation community, and I think the ag sector often wasn't at the table when they needed to be because of some of those historical tensions we've been talking about. And the last sector to be invited traditionally has been public health. These are not groups that really have worked very well together, and it's not just Southern Africa. I should be very clear. We have the same issues here. Only relatively recently, in the wake of things like the monkeypox outbreak and SARS and now avian influenza and swine flu, have we really started to see within our own government good collaboration between, you know, the public health community, HHS and CDC and USDA and USAID, Department of Interior. That type of collaboration is really relatively new wherever you go. We feel like we've been a catalyst on that. And our focus has been in Southern Africa. But today, I think it's fair to say in many ways the Southern Africans are ahead of us here in the U.S. because things like transfrontier conservation have forced a collaboration that was long overdue. And it often, as in many situations, as we've seen over and over again in many sectors, it often takes a crisis to get people to rethink their approaches to problem solving.
Can you talk a little bit about the Peace Parks movement? Because we keep referring to it, but I wanted to just back up and get a little history of the Peace Parks movement in there.
Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert on it, but I would say probably around 15 or maybe a few more years ago, there was the Peace Parks Foundation, actually, in South Africa, who really started to talk about this vision for, you know, reconnecting wild areas. And I think, you know, we collaborate with the Peace Parks Foundation. I think they have brought a lot of focus to the value of wildlife as, again, as an part of an engine of economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa. But the driver was conservation. And I think at the time, the livestock sector wasn't necessarily seen as the stakeholder that it really was. And that was a bit of a problem, I think, for Peace Parks to really get political traction. I think we're well beyond that now. And I do think the cross-sectoral implications of that kind of land use change at the scale that transfrontier conservation implies, I think it's now happening in the context of, you know, cross-sectoral collaboration. But the original Peace Parks drivers were largely conservationists with good intentions, but they weren't thinking as cross-sectorally as they needed to. And maybe it's easier for me to say it in hindsight, although I was at some of those tables at the time, and I felt this way. And part of my experience listening to the vision at that time really did drive me to think about creating AHEAD, because I was worried that without a cross-sectoral approach, this great idea would stumble. And I think now that we're collaborating and we're bringing these sectors together, I think there's a much greater chance that good decisions will be made and transfrontier conservation will be successful where it can be, and in places where it doesn't make social or economic sense, it won't happen. And that's okay, too.
And so where is AHEAD working?
Well, I should say, if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, there are right now 13 areas that countries have agreed are either already transfrontier conservation areas or have been designated as places where they would like to explore creating transfrontier conservation areas. If you add up these 13 areas, and this goes back to the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that I was talking about earlier, the importance economically of wildlife, the land area we're talking about of those 13 areas, if you added it all up, it's about 120 million hectares. That's about the same as New York, Texas, and California combined, just to give you some sense of scale. We're talking about a vast portion of sub-Saharan Africa where the primary land use could be wildlife. So we're talking about a big impact. We are providing technical guidance basically wherever we're asked and resources allow. We have to find funding for anything we do. So we've gotten funding in the Great Limpopo Transfrontier Conservation Area from a variety of donors over the years, including the MacArthur Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, some funding from USAID and others. And most recently, we have gotten some support from USAID to help what could become the largest transfrontier conservation area, not only in Africa, but on the planet. Five countries have come together to create what's called the Kavango Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. And it's just really in the early stages. It's where Angola, Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, and Zimbabwe come together. If you add up the area they're looking at, it's about 400,000 square kilometers. That's about 1.5 times the size of Great Britain. It's vast. And right now, within that general area, there are about 36 national parks and other types of wildlife areas. Not connected necessarily, but the vision is connectivity. And it's really the type of challenge that AHEAD was created to assist with. Because if you flew over this area, you would see lots, miles and miles of fences, largely because of foot and mouth disease control. And some of the tools we've talked about earlier, looking at new ways to facilitate export agriculture, to facilitate getting beef out of Southern Africa to Europe without necessarily requiring that level of fencing, offers extraordinary opportunities to reconcile this conflict. Right now, under current policy, you really can't create a transfrontier conservation area. Those fences will not be realigned. They will not be taken down at any point. And so connectivity can't happen. The only way it can happen is if we find new ways from a policy point of view to ensure safe production of beef from a disease point of view that would allow other tools besides fencing to be applied so that corridors and historical migration routes could be restored. And again, this part of the world, tourism is only growing. And that's what the leaders of these countries are seeing as, again, they're a part of their future.
Why is this multi-sectoral approach so important?
We're living in a very challenging time, and we look at things like climate change. And I think it's really important. You know, just like you want to have a diversified investment portfolio, you want to have a diversified, economic or livelihood portfolio. And for example, if, as many predictions indicate, parts of Southern Africa get much, much drier, wildlife often does much better at those times. And people can still come and see wildlife at times of drought. Wildlife evolved in this region. When the rains are good and livestock is incredibly productive, that's great too. To have your eggs in multiple baskets so that people's livelihoods can benefit from both natural resources like wildlife as well as livestock, that's a win-win. And that's what we're very interested in facilitating. The idea of creating transfrontier conservation areas is so antithetical to the history of the region. That's partly what makes it exciting. And I think if we get this right, if we can get these different sectors to the table, if we as facilitators can continue to help bridge some of the language gaps, the technical gaps between the ag sector, the wildlife sector, and the public health sector, I think the potential to transform the economy of the region is really there in a way that we haven't seen in decades.
What's involved in creating a transfrontier conservation area? Because you politically have to be working together, and then physically you have to create those corridors. In this case, it would be removing fences. But what all is involved?
No, to be fair, I've been focusing largely on the animal health dimension. But if you think about it, there's all kinds of ministries that have to be involved. You have customs and immigration issues. There's law enforcement issues. And so you're basically talking about creating a connection that hasn't been there in many cases for many, many years. And there's also revenue sharing issues. If we're going to expand tourism and people are coming to a transfrontier area, if a tourist spends all their time in country A but not in country B, but they came because of the idea of a big area, does country B get a portion of those revenues? All those issues are on the table in these places and being discussed. So there are political issues, there are economic issues, and then there are physical issues, as you said. Sometimes it involves modifying habitats, rezoning. It may involve having people graze livestock in a different way. In some places, it may involve essentially fencing livestock in instead of wildlife out. We call that compartmentalization, and it's a way to enhance biosecurity of livestock without necessarily cutting off a wildlife migration route. So there's lots of on-the-ground work that needs to be done and lots of policy work that needs to be done.
Are there examples of where it's already worked?
We have transfrontier conservation areas in the world. Probably the most well-known in Africa is the Serengeti Mara ecosystem between Kenya and Tanzania, which is centered around the migratory system driven by wildebeest, for example. So that's an existing area where there isn't a border fence and animals move across an international boundary and tourists come to both sides. And it's a very interesting example. It does have some problems, and there are some threats, by very real threats, to the Serengeti Mara.
How about in North America?
And in North America, too, we have, you know, shared conservation areas between the United States and Canada. And the Peace Parks movement has certainly expanded beyond Southern Africa. I know that they've been interested in the idea of a peace park between North and South Korea, where land use could be focused on wildlife and potentially diffuse tensions. That's where the term peace park comes through. You know, it's being looked at in places like Mongolia, Russia, and China, and even in terms of Pakistan and Afghanistan. There are people who are looking at transfrontier conservation as a way to bridge problems that have persisted politically for many years. And I think in some places it might work, in some places it won't. So I don't want my emphasis on the animal health dimension to belie the complexity of this type of endeavor.
Now, the animal health dimension can really scuttle the success of a transfrontier conservation area.
Well, right. And I see the animal health issues as make or break, which is why we've created AHEAD and are investing in it. Because even if you get everything else right, it certainly in the Southern Africa context, if you don't deal with this conflict between export agriculture and the current regulations that require physical separation of wildlife and livestock by fencing, if you don't deal with that, then you won't have a peace park. And so the good news is, since those fences were first put up in the late 50s and 60s and since, we have learned a lot more about diseases like foot and mouth and ways to create, as I was saying earlier, safe beef products so that importing countries can be assured that the product they're importing won't bring foot and mouth disease into their country. Those methods exist, and now it's a matter of setting up, helping people understand what they are, creating some pilot projects, very, you know, incrementally and cautiously looking at new models to prove that they work. You need proof of concept so that eventually policy change can be adopted. And as I was saying, some of these win-win opportunities can really be implemented.
Have people started experimenting with some of these win-win opportunities? I'd love for you to talk again about the foot and mouth disease and what can be done or what you're experimenting with in this region, the Kavango.
Well, I mean, right now we are in the early stages of working with a whole range of partners from the different sectors to look at what's called something like commodity-based trade.
What is commodity-based trade?
Commodity-based trade is one potential tool that's being evaluated, and what it essentially is, it's a way of changing the way cattle are handled and the way beef is produced. All with existing tools. This doesn't involve inventing any new methodologies, really, because it's used in other parts of the world. If you are worried about foot and mouth, for example, and you run cattle through the right types of quarantine, if they have foot and mouth, you'll be able to detect it. And beyond that, the way you handle meat after you harvest it from cattle, the way it's aged, the way it's deboned, the way it's processed, lymph nodes removed, etc., you can produce a very safe product from a foot and mouth disease point of view and from a food safety point of view. And there's a sort of a double benefit here. Right now, countries that export beef to Europe, they're exporting, they're not exporting a processed product, really. And the real value added happens in the importing country. And so really, the exporting country is losing out on economic benefit. If value added processing occurs, say, in Botswana, and that meat can go to Europe in a more finished form, they can get a higher price per unit of production. That's hugely important in terms of economic development. At the same time, if that value-added processing can be scientifically proven through normal scientific food handling and safety standards, if it can be proven to be free of foot and mouth disease, then the justification for current approaches to disease control, some of these cordon fences, would really not all be necessary anymore. There may be certain circumstances where you still need fences for a variety of reasons, but you could theoretically still produce safe meat from an export point of view, but also open up some of these corridors to meet the transfrontier vision. And again, the economic multiplier of having that type of land use diversification could be huge and would feed in very nicely to, you know, the development assistance goals of countries like the United States, who are putting, you know, under Secretary Clinton right now, a huge emphasis on food security and economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa. And we think it's time for the conservation community and the ag community to put their heads together on things like commodity-based trade and really exploit it for the benefit of African economic development.
So what's stopping that from happening?
The science is there. Now it's a matter of, again, piloting it and getting political will to buy into it. And I'm optimistic that, you know, if we're patient and everybody works together and we develop those real partnerships, you know, among the donors, among the host country implementers, and among NGOs like us and academia, et cetera, I think we can do this.
Let's talk more about the implications of all of this for human health.
Our very health is tied to this relationship. Most of the emerging diseases that we see around the world are diseases that are jumping often from wildlife either into domestic animals and then to people or directly into people.
Tell me more about that, how these diseases are jumping and what kind of diseases we're talking about.
We hear a lot about monkeypox and a whole host of diseases. I'd love to talk specifics about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, I mean, I'll give you one of these sort of gee whiz examples. You know, if you've heard of Nipah virus, you know, out in places like Malaysia, this is an issue, and I'm not an expert in it, where land use change has changed the ecology of the system and led to an emerging disease. This is a case where so much forest has been cleared and pig production has increased dramatically. And what's happened is the bats who need trees to roost in and fruit trees now find themselves in trees that are overhanging piggeries.
And what does that mean for disease?
And so the secretions, the fecal matter, et cetera, of the bats is over the piggeries. And the bats are natural hosts of viruses like Nipah. And it gets into pigs and gets into people. And it's a fatal disease. That lack of understanding of the relationships between where we site agriculture and where, you know, where wildlife needs to roost, in this case, is a great example of a huge cost being borne by our own ignorance, if you will.
Can you tell me about some other examples?
And even look at what's happened with the swine flu outbreaks. Obviously, you know, we've known for many, many years that we shouldn't, keep poultry and pigs together if we can avoid it, because influenza viruses easily cycle among us, birds, and pigs. And pigs are a perfect mixing vessel for new viruses. They're so much like us. And so we've actually done very poorly in terms of even keeping the tabs on the various influenza viruses that are in our piggeries, in our pig production facilities, at the same time that, you know, factory farming has become the norm and we have densities of farm animals that are extremely conducive to the spread of diseases compared to the way animals used to be raised historically.
Are there other examples of where we set up situations where these pathogens can mix so easily?
And another development that's relatively recent in its intensity is the harvesting of wildlife. If we go to Southeast Asia, whether you're in Cambodia or Vietnam or China, and you look at these wet markets where wildlife is collected live and dead and mixed together and with domestic animals, these are huge mixing bowls and huge opportunities for pathogens to jump species. So this is where we have things like SARS jumping out, okay? And we have new pathogens arising all the time because we're giving them the opportunity to do so. The consumption of bushmeat alone is really what has driven the emergence of HIV/AIDS, which we now know came from chimps many decades ago because people butchered chimps. And that's when the virus had a chance to jump. The Ebola outbreaks that we continue to see in many places often come from people consuming gorillas who have picked it up. And so we're working in Central Africa, for example, to raise awareness about this, creating economic opportunities related to things like gorilla tourism, at the same time helping people understand that they're better off not eating gorillas. It's good for conservation, obviously, but it's also good for public health.
Do you help to issue, say, public health warnings about some of these potential diseases?
We actually do wildlife surveillance, and we can tell when we find dead gorillas or dead duikers in the forests. We can alert the public health community that a wave of Ebola is potentially about to occur, and by changing people's behavior and the way they interact with wildlife, we can mitigate outbreaks of human Ebola. So there are examples of like this all around the world, where we alter our behaviors or we alter our habitats, and we can either alter them for the better and mitigate the emergence of disease, or we can do things that are likely to exacerbate disease transmission. And the choice is ours. The science is there, and we're working very hard right now to in all parts of the world to get people to think proactively about these relationships, because our own health depends on it. The next emerging disease may be the one that we just aren't able to beat back.
Here in the United States, what are some examples of these zoonotic diseases when a disease has jumped from a wild animal to humans?
Well, monkeypox is sort of the prototypical example, and this is an issue that still really isn't completely resolved. That outbreak came from the there's a whole industry related to pocket pets and other pets, and in this case, there were prairie dogs held in nearby Gambian pouched rats. And this was related to the pet trade. And the Gambian rats harbored the monkeypox virus, which jumped into the prairie dogs, which then jumped into the people who bought their prairie dogs, I think, at a swap meet out in the Midwest. Now, hopefully that virus, monkeypox, has not gotten into the wild. I mean, when this hit the news, there was a concern that people were going to throw their prairie dogs out in the backyard because they were afraid. And that, you know, it still might have happened. But that disease jumped from a wild animal from Central Africa, you know, to a semi-domesticated animal that was being used as a pet, in this case, prairie dogs, and then into people. Another example is the ongoing issue related to brucellosis in the American West, which was a livestock disease that then moved into the bison and elk of Yellowstone. And it is a zoonotic disease. Brucellosis, undulant fever, is a disease that can affect people. And there's been an ongoing conflict between livestock agriculture and the management of Yellowstone's wildlife because of brucellosis. So there are issues all over the place. There's a very interesting one that's been documented on the West Coast related to toxoplasmosis. Researchers in California have found that sea otters are often affected and often eventually die from toxoplasmosis, and they believe it relates to the thousands, the tons of cat feces that end up outflowing into the Pacific.
Really? Because,
yeah, people have pet cats, and the toxoplasmosis gets into the water. It gets harvested by the food of the sea otters in the shellfish, and then the sea otters eat it. And who would have thought that? And so now there's an effort, you know, to not have people, for example, flush cat feces down the drain, down the toilet, and the control of the disposal of litter. I mean, who would have thought that we could have impacts at that scale? But there are so many of us that these things are all connected now. And unfortunately, we often only figure it out after the fact. But I think we've been greatly sensitized to it recently, given all the outbreaks, including the obvious scare over bird flu, over H5N1. And the relationships there, there are relationships between wild birds and poultry and people. And we've spent a lot of time and effort investigating those relationships in different parts of the world. And, by a better understanding the relationship, you can then mitigate through enhanced biosecurity, through where you site your agriculture, for what kind of surveillance you do.
Can you tell me how this all worked with respect to the bird flu?
You know, with the bird flu, it was really clear that we really hadn't had a good One Health model in place. In places like Indonesia, we were discovering bird flu when people were dying. We should be finding bird flu when it's still in chickens. But because the veterinary infrastructure in that case was so weak, it wasn't picked up. If we were getting it right, we'll detect these issues in their points of origin much earlier on in the process. And ideally, over time, as we educate ourselves, we'll be making our investments to prevent these things. We'll be thinking much more proactively about deforestation and changing where we put up dams, because those types of land use changes are often what precipitate changes in ecology that lead to emerging diseases, whether it's the resurgence of malaria we see around logging areas in the Amazon, areas that are often being cleared in order to produce more land for livestock grazing. The relationship between those land use changes and huge public health costs are very real. And we're still not very good at recognizing that ahead of time. And we're often looking at short-term profits as opposed to long-term costs. And we need to get by that. And the whole One World, One Health approach is about thinking about this stuff more proactively, using good science, but not waiting until the outbreak, but trying to be more contemplative in the land use decisions that we make and their likely outcomes.
So tell me about this One World, One Health approach, and tell me about the creation of AHEAD, which stands for Animal and Human Health for the Environment and Development. What are its objectives?
Well, I think, you know, it was the Wildlife Conservation Society among NGOs, if you think about U.S.-based international NGOs that work in conservation, you know, the African Wildlife Foundations, the Nature Conservancies, Conservation International, World Wildlife Fund types, we're all colleagues, we all work together. Well, we're the only organization that actually has a veterinary program. And we found that to be extremely advantageous because a lot of the issues that we've been talking about related to conservation and development have a health dimension. First of all, everybody wants to be healthy, and everyone who depends on livestock, which is much of the developing world, wants their livestock to be healthy. And so it gives us an entry point to have people see the relevance of people who care not only about public health and agriculture, but people who care about conservation, because these things, as we've been saying, are all linked. And AHEAD, which we started, I brought the concept to WCS back in 2002, and it was really our first One Health initiative where we started in Southern Africa. And since then, we've now launched a number of programs that take the same theme, the theme being looking at the nexus of wildlife health, domestic animal health, human health, and environmental stewardship, and applied it in different situations. So we have a program called GAINS. That stands for the Wild Bird Global Avian Influenza Network for Surveillance. And that was a program funded largely by USAID and the CDC and several other partners to look at wild birds and their role in and impact from H5N1 avian influenza. There was a big concern that wild birds were spreading this disease around the world, and we were brought in this case, to help evaluate that. And where in the world was that an important issue? And we were concerned from a conservation point of view that wild birds were going to be blamed everywhere. And this was happening. There were countries where the Ministry of Agriculture, instead of looking at the fact that they were importing infected day-old chicks from China across the world into their country, they were pointing their fingers at wild birds and saying, the wild birds, they are giving us this disease. Well, with some good surveillance, we were able to demonstrate in certain cases that, in fact, it wasn't the case. And it was poultry trade, often illegal poultry trade, that was spreading this very dangerous disease. Now, in some parts of the world, wild birds are definitely a component. And it's important to know where and when. We also have One World and One Health initiatives where we work in a specific country to bring the different sectors together. We've been doing that in Mongolia with great success and great partnership with various parts of the Mongolian government. We have a lot of programs across Latin America where our teams bring these different sectors together to think about how to improve conservation and development outcomes, how to deal with issues like avian influenza, etc. So we're seeing an increased demand. We've had a number of conferences. We have every few years, we have a big conference on One World, One Health. And now, it's taken off, and we see the WHO has a One World, One Health initiative, and there are One World, One Health organizations. And so we feel very good about the fact that we don't have ownership of this concept. We do feel like we were a catalytic, but the idea is a very old one, the idea of the relationship between veterinary medicine and human health and environmental stewardship. That's not new.
What is new?
What's new is actually applying it now in the complex world we live in, and we're seeing a lot of parties do that now. You know, as I said, across the UN system in various countries. So I think you're only going to continue to hear more and more of that. And I think that the AHEAD work was really part of what ignited that. And I'm personally very excited about that. And I want to continue to see different entities unrelated to WCS adopting this model, because we think it's got a lot of important applications.
What could people do if they're interested in this nexus between wildlife, livestock, and human health?
Well, I think they can educate themselves. They can educate themselves, and I'm sure Vermont is a part of the country that's ahead of the curve in terms of the types of food we buy and the linkages between our consumption patterns and climate change and whether we carpool to work or ride our bicycle. All these issues are very, very closely related. How our food is raised, the organic movement versus non-organic. These are all, in my mind, part of the same relationships. in terms of helping directly with things like the AHEAD program and WCS's other One Health initiatives, I'd encourage anyone who's interested to visit our websites. And if you go to WCS-AHEAD, you know, WCS with a hyphen, ahead.org, I have a ton of information on our efforts. And there's a lot of information on our programs around the world at WCS.org. And if any of your listeners want to get in touch with you and you want to funnel them on to me personally, I'm happy to respond to questions and find ways to plug them in.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks again.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into the intersection between wildlife, livestock, and human health with wildlife vet Steve Osofsky. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. The animals that make these sounds are large primates that live in the volcanic mountains of the Central African countries of Rwanda and Uganda. Do you know what they are yet? They're mountain gorillas. Once again, here's the sound of mountain gorillas. Episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.